Today in the Grave Talks, our continuing conversation with Jill Marie Morris about the house that once stood at 207 in Watervliet. On our previous episode of the Grave Talks, we've been talking with Jill Marie Morris about her harrowing experience at the building marked 207 in Watervliet in upstate New York, a home that her and her husband shared for a short period of time until tragedy struck. Initially, she felt very odd. She felt the ominous forces and power at work in the property. Her husband seemed to be consciously somewhat oblivious to it, but yet overtaken by them. Ending on the evening of June 28th, 1989, after months of relentless emotional and spiritual torture, Jill's husband cornered her and their 8-month-old son with a loaded 12-gauge shotgun. With only moments to spare, Jill's mother saved her daughter and grandson from a brutal murder-suicide plot. Shortly after those heroic efforts of her mother, Jill's husband shot and killed himself in the living room of 207. However, this horror story does not end there. Jill began to research the property, the experiences that she had beyond the tragic incident with her deceased husband, and began to find very peculiar, very disturbing, and seemingly somewhat of an attempt to cover up information on what once happened at 207.
Yeah, it was kind of an eye-opener. Being local to the area, it's funny how much you don't get taught in school about the local history. It was just really fascinating. Well, for the first thing I did is I knew there was, like, in speaking with my grandmother, there was something Native American, very based, that she kept talking about. I kept saying, but I couldn't quite figure it out. She just said the house, especially after there was one thing I failed to say, which was in 207, my grandmother came back from a trip to Italy and Poland in the spring of 1989, and she actually got to shake hands with the Pope John Paul II. The picture's on my website. There's two pictures. And she's in a red blazer. She got to shake his hand. She was, like, in all her glory, and she brought the actual photograph to our house with some gifts from her trip. And that was the only time she was in the house, and she said she'd never go back, especially after what my husband did, which was, so I'm looking at the picture, I'm like, oh my gosh, Graham, this is wonderful, this is beautiful. And I put the picture on Jim's lap, like on his knees, and he completely freaked out. It was terrible. I felt more so terrible for my grandmother. He ran into the bedroom, he made a bunch of noise, he ran out of the house, come to find out he took the crucifix off our bedroom wall, he shoved it in my drawer. It was bizarre, his reaction. So going back to that, we had always talked about, she said, Jill, there's something very evil going on in this house. And she goes, I don't think the Native American aspect, even after he died, she goes, I don't think that's it. She goes, but there's something there, and I agreed. So I went back, I said, well, if I'm going to start, I'm going to go way back to the earliest point that there's any kind of recorded history in the city of Watervliet. So had to put my feelers out because there were multiple Native American encampments in the city, and found that the Iroquois Mohawk Indians really dominated that area, and that the Algonquin Indians had come over from eastern New York State across the river when it froze, the Hudson River. They would come over and they set up these little encampments right where 207 was, but they would get raided by the Mohawks. And so there was the base camp located, like, almost on 207's property, and then there was one up by the high school, and they would get raided by the Mohawks at times. So I found that information. Somebody knew, one of my sources knew I was looking for information. She's a journalist, and she put out her feelers and got me in touch with the historian for the indigenous people of New York State, which is Doug Kinateo. And he got a hold of me, and he gave me quite a bit of information, which is cited in the book, our emails. He gave me permission to go ahead and post them. And he said there was a massacre that occurred before the town was even settled, right on 207's property. He said several hundred Native Americans died and they were not properly mourned. He said right there that causes a spiritual issue because of Native American culture has very specific burial and mourning protocol. So he said that took place, you know, before the civilization of the area. So when talking to him, he had asked me, he goes, did you see, I know you felt what this presence, but did you ever see it? And I never saw it. I saw something manifest as the priest. And in the book, you'll see the conversations because they're the excerpts from the emails. They're actually the full emails between the two of us, our conversations. So he gave me the first tidbit that, okay, something really awful happened here centuries ago, 1500s-ish. So then the city with the Hudson River and the explorers coming up the Hudson River, they discover, oh, lovely, lovely, lovely place to set up fur trading. The town of Watervliet goes way back. The settlers kicked the what was left of the Native Americans, pushed them out of Watervliet. But it was an established, and they knew this, sacred ground. This is a fact, that the sacred ground runs from the Cohoes Falls, which is just north of Watervliet, on the same side of the river, down to Port Schuyler, which is just south of Watervliet. It puts Watervliet right in the middle of this sacred ground, and it was a very spiritual place of celebration and worship. So that's where the massacre had happened, and Doug felt that that was a big influence, but not the whole picture. So moving forward in time, I found that during the canal being built, the Erie Canal, that it was, Watervliet was like rough and tumble town. It was considered the Barbary Coast of the East Coast. It was very violent. They would have ships come up the river and dock. There at one time were 77 bars in Watervliet, brothels, so on and so forth. But they would get off the ship, drink. There would be a lot of murders, dead bodies floating all over the place, found in the streets. They couldn't keep the police force. This is all cited factual information. So we've got that whole, it was known as Murder Town, actually, period in the 1800s during the industrialization of the city. Then you go into the, they really, the founding member of who founded Watervliet and kind of got control of it was Father William Sheehan, who built the second thing 300 feet just west of 207. And he really was seen as the law keeper. You know, people were afraid of him. He was very good to his people, but at the same time, he ruled with an iron fist. All that information came up. I tried to get property records for 207, and I was denied that. Actually, that's well documented in the book. My requests, even though it's public information, were denied.
Being denied such public, normal information that anyone may have a use for, from a real estate agent to just someone researching history for a class. Why would this information be held back?
The property records were still there, but I was like, they gave me a runaround you would not believe. And I was doing this long distance. I was going from California to New York. I was going from Florida to New York, spending time trying to get all this, like going to meet people. Every time I'd show up at the county clerk's office, there was a snafu. Finally, I said, listen, there was a woman and a man who helped me. I was able to get some information, but to go into the city of Watervliet is where the big denial was. I was followed. This is in the book. And this is really what made me more so determined to get to the bottom of the history of this house, because I went to the Hall of Records in for Albany County and literally had somebody show up, and like the second or third time I had been there, and sit up, and he sat across from me and questioned me and watched everything I did for hours. And I said, this is like ridiculous. All I want is information on this property and the surrounding homes. And when it came to tax records and things of that nature, that they're still on file, I thought I was making progress until when I went to make the appointment to, oh, I'm sorry, we've relocated the boxes with that property's information. We have no idea where they are. It was one nonsensical thing after another.
There's inefficiencies quite often in government. However, this seems to be something far beyond an inefficiency.
Absolutely. And that's it. Because, you know, I've dealt with city government, and there's never been any kind of big deal, you know, researching things. You know, real estate agents do it all the time. You have to do record searches and so on and so forth. So I could not understand. Well, at one point, so one of my dear friends, Justin, who lived in New York City, who used to work for the court clerk down in New York City records department, he's like, I'm going to take a trip up there. Let me see if I can incognito just kind of go, and I'll go to the historical, because even the historical society shut me down for the city of Waterville. And I was like, this is ridiculous. This is like so BS. I hate to say it, but that's what it was. So Justin took a trip with his wife as just sightseers. Nobody knows who Justin is. The minute he starts asking, you know, he goes to Historical Society. He's like, oh, you know, what about the canal period? And, oh, so, yeah, I heard that there's this book 207, you know, about this house. You know, what's the deal with who owned that house? And shut him down. Totally shut him down. So he reported that back to me, and he goes, something's going on, Jill. He goes, because Donna and I went up there, and they shut us right out. So I tried reaching out to the Historical Society several times and was just met with ridiculous excuses. They said in the book, well, when I reported that factually, they said I made it up. No, I did not, because if you think about it, really, that makes no sense. I spent 3 years researching this book. Why would I just not contact them? I have the emails. I have, you know what I'm saying? So it was just, there was some type of cover up involved, but we were still able to get a lot of information. But it took, like I said, 3 years poring over newspaper articles going back to the 1800s by that address. The street name changed a couple times, as did, but the number remained pretty consistent. And, it was named as Genesee Street at one point, then it was 19th Street, and then it was moved around a couple more times. But we were able to find a lot of the property record information from last will and testaments and deeds attached to those names. So it took a lot of backwards kind of research. So by the time all was said and done, we had factual data. The first death reported in 207 was a little girl. In 1896, I believe it was. I think it was 1896. It's in the book. And she died. She probably had the flu, but she died in the house, and she was waked in the house. And then, shockingly, from 1942 to 1992 were most of the deaths. There were a total that we found, record-wise, 14 deaths in the house. Three suicides, two of them male by gunshot. One was my husband, one was the tenant when Joe owned the house, and the other was a male that hung himself between the third floor and the second floor in the center hallway. So the house proved to have this issue. I do believe what I get into is it does have a downflow vortex. There's upflows, which are good, positive. You see those types of at the Sedona Desert, very positive energy coming out of these vortexes. A downflow will suck everything negative in, and it just kind of festers. And I do believe that's what 207, the property, is. So it's very strange when you read these deaths. There was a couple cancers, but out of the 14, three suicides, a lot of emergency, like drop dead type of situations. They're all cited. Their obituaries are in there. And normally, in a house that's that old, it's going to occur. Okay, there's going to be death. But when you look at specifically from 1942 to 1992. It seems that the closer you get to 92, it escalates. The stranger things start happening. The suicides all happened between 1950 and 1989, two of which, the first two, were pretty close together. So then you have other stories. The lady that I found out that had lived there before we moved into 207, I mentioned, thinking it was odd, her personal effects, some of them were left in the house. And I said, doesn't she want these? And he goes, no, she doesn't want to come back to the house. And then this area that was roughly left in the middle of the living room with the floor, apparently I had been told well after the fact that it was because somebody was practicing devil worship in the house and drew something on the floor and they were trying to scrub it out. So there's a whole bunch of history that takes place, but a lot of negative historical history right there on that location, and it's carried over. The city is dense, or it used to be very densely populated, so you're going to have a higher number of things go on, but it's a blue-collar, very closely knit, predominantly Catholic area, and the number of suicides in this city, especially recently, since, like, if you start going back 60s and coming forward, is it's staggering. And I still hear of these things occurring, like, really close to the house. I have it, like, a little map with these little pinpoints, like polka dots I've drawn on the map. It's bizarre. It is extremely bizarre. I've looked into water testing. I've looked into air testing. I have looked into speaking with engineers. I have spoke with multiple clergy people in the area. It's bizarre. It is really, truly bizarre what is going on. One thing I've noticed, because I am writing the third book that I said I'd never write, but because so much continues to come in, and it has drawn me, something came up relative to my family with the Native American history to this whole thing. I had an experience in 2015, and I said, holy cow, I think this is what this is. I have learned that you really have to encompass everything and then kind of go backwards and kind of, it's not like you cherry pick, it's the opposite. You have to take every little thing and look at a possible cause. And there's really no rhyme or real reason. I have my opinion of what it is, but it's not good. And it affects a lot of people. I can't tell you how many house investigations I've done in Waterville, how many people have legitimate paranormal activity. Some of it is benign, it's not harmful, but then there's things that, there's very strange things that occur.
Let me ask you that, Joe. What exactly is your opinion on what is haunting this area?
Okay, so in growing up, obviously, my great-great-grandmother was the tribal medicine woman for her tribe, Chippewa tribe. She married a Seneca Indian, which is Iroquois, which they're not, that's like a big taboo thing. There's a whole funny kind of family story, but not so funny, on how when John and Gertrude got married, it was like they were both shunned from their respective families because the two different Iroquois and Algonquians were not supposed to do that. Just on an aside, Iroquois looks at the Algonquian like, you're crazy. You believe in all this mysticism, and they called it magic and things like that, which Native Americans have their beliefs, but they looked at the Algonquians like, this is taboo. So right from that, there is what I saw, and in reference to this, if you go to my website and you go to the book page and you scroll down, there's a bunch of pictures. On June 15th was the first time, all these years later, in a dream, that thing revealed itself to me that was hiding in the form of the pastor. It literally popped out of, like I would say, the skin of the priest in the dream and revealed itself to me. I jumped up, out of bed, ran into the living room, scared the daylights out of my mother, and drew it, what I saw. And you'll see two pictures in pencil, which are my drawings of that night when it happened. Because I'd gone to bed early, had the nightmare, woke up, drew it, went back to bed, and then had a premonition because the creature came back. Now, with that, I threw it out into the public on Facebook, I think it was. I said, I just had this horrible premonition. If anybody wants to take this as research and look into this creature, because my mother was begging me, don't. My mother's like, don't you do it. Let somebody else do it, because she's just protecting me. And so some people did take to it, and it kept coming back to this weird legend. And I was like, what is that? And it comes back to the legend of the Wendigo. And I was like, this is just a legend. This is like, this doesn't make any sense, but this is weird because this is describing what I saw and what it said it was going to do. And in the premonition, that's documented publicly out there. It unfolded the next day. So I was like, holy cow, this is evil. This thing is evil. And so looking into the legend, I was informed by another Native American spiritualist that I've talked with about this third book, is the only people that can control, allegedly, the Wendigo are shaman, medicine women, and spiritual leaders. And they were the only ones that could control and get rid of them. Now, from the perspective of my great-great-grandmother, she was a medicine woman. So I think that with what was said to me in hindsight, which I documented what was said to me, that creature said, watch what I'm going to do. It was scared of me. It was afraid of me in the dream. I wasn't afraid of it. It was afraid of me. And it was like retaliating against me. And what I found interesting was reading about Wendigo, that they're controlled by the spiritual leaders of the Algonquian tribe. So then I looked into bringing it modern day. There was a logical study done. There was called a phenomenon called the Wendigo phenomenon, which was, this is going to sound so bizarre, but really it's the basis for zombies, which is so bizarre because, again, this is all backwards research, that the Wendigo is a flesh-eating, blood-sucking demon that feeds on the living. And it can take the form of a person. And there were these cases that you can find if you Google them about Wendigo psychosis by the American Journal of Psychology. That's what they call this, is that these people claim to be inhabited, and they've studied these cases. Some are unfounded, some are questionable. Like, what, there's some very interesting things that come up, that these people become allegedly possessed, and their goal is to destroy. These demons is to destroy. I think any demon, their goal is to destroy, but that's what they do. And if it gets to a certain point, they can actually attack people and eat them. So it's kind of interesting when you're reading these psychology articles, that even present day, that they'll go back and they'll say, you know, this in a loosely tied way is like almost like the premise for this zombie thing, but it goes back to a demon. So it's interesting because with my, and I don't want to give away the whole thing for the next book, but there's so many ties that go back to this Wendigo thing in my family history that it's shocking. It's almost like a retribution towards me anyway, meaning that part of it. But what I think happened is I do think that the priest was consumed by a fracture. The priest had some type of, whether it was alcohol, I'm not saying that's the case, but alcoholism could be anything, an illness. He knew that this was present. And I do believe, based on the research, that he kept it at bay, and that's what made him so strange. I think that's why, ironically, on Christmas Eve, Christmas morning, when that apparition appeared and pretended to be the priest in front of the tree, that's actually where my husband shot and killed himself, was in that spot where it appeared. And it was evil from the moment I saw it. And there is a whole, it all goes back to the day my husband died. June 28th was also the Golden Jubilee anniversary of the priest so many years ago prior to that. There's dates that correlate with a lot of different things. I do think he tried his best to manage what he could. I think he knew he was trying to keep this thing at bay, in my opinion. And when he died, it just kind of has gone haywire again. So it's odd, though, that after 1942, there were direct ties of the priest to that house, to 207. And there were some other interesting things that come up relative to what was going on at 207. But as far as what the history that's hidden is pure speculation, but nonetheless interesting in the grander scheme of things with families of the area at that time that are still have family ties there now.
It's such a puzzling story as far as why they will not release this information, why they gave you such a runaround. Let me ask you, were you ever able to get to the bottom of why it became so difficult, nearly impossible, to get the basic information that you were seeking out?
Well, so that's an excellent question. The answer is no particular definitive answer, but I will tell you, so St. Patrick's Church was 300 feet west of 207. That was also taken down terribly so in 2012. In April 2012, they demolished the church and built a grocery store. And it was a historical building, and it's really, truly a shame. There's been a lot of paranormal activity. A lot of these dots that I have on my map, the suicides occur right around the church. Right around the church and right very close to it. And this is long after the church was not functioning. So, but what's interesting is there's also some very specific information that's occurred relative to murders, strange, bizarre things that have taken place right in that vicinity as well. I do think that part of it is church related with these families that from the interviews that I've done, that there is a strong connection to. There is a strong connection, like I said, to the house. Some of the owners of the house back in the late 1800s, 1893 through 19, the same family owned 207, 1893 through the 1950s, and they were closely tied to St. Patrick's Church. And in the 1800s, there's information putting the priests in 207. Now, could something have, there is, it's definitely a protective measure. There's this whole thing that happened with the bell to the church. For example, one of the biggest clues to me that indicates that something was going on with the priest, and again, this is a very Catholic-oriented community, when the bell was put up on the church on Easter Sunday of, I can't remember the year, the dedication, the inscription of the bell that Father Sheehan had put on the bell is of itself bizarre, and it's what it translates to is, on your knee you should stand before not only God but the underworld. That is God's honest truth, the inscription on the bell. And so that set the precedent for the church when it was erected. So you have this bizarre inscription, and I discussed this in great detail and interview somebody from the Catholic Church, from the diocese in Albany, about the bell, and about, Peter even said, he goes, you know, on one note, it makes sense, but really, it doesn't. It's very strange. It's a strange inscription to put on a church bell. So it's almost like, but he was, the priest was also very heavily influenced in his schooling in Ireland, because I went way back. I found out where he lived, where he grew up, his family, where he went to school, seminary school, the whole nine yards. Tracked him right straight through here in the U.S. He was involved with a monastery that was in Ireland, heavily into mysticism in the 1800s, into darker things. So it transfers over. That's why I'm saying there's a lot of protection. I think family names that may have, I know pretty much every name of every person in every flat. Well, it went, once it was turned into a bunch of apartments, from the late 1800s until it was torn down. I have a list of families. That's how I found out who died in the house, by their names and the city records, or the public, what do you call those things? City directories, which were online. So that was very helpful. But I do think it's a protective measure around family members that supported the priest, and so forth. That's all I really want to say about that. I know it sounds really coy, but I get really, it goes into the hypothesis. It's not a fact. So to answer your question, no, I don't have a real definitive answer. But if you line up the facts, it points to covering up names.
Why would those names be covered up? What could this dark history be? Jill is, like you heard, working on another book. We'll hope to have her back in the future on the Grave Talks to talk about what she's discovered or is about to discover about this very, very intriguing area. Jill, thank you for talking with us today. If you'd like to learn more about Jill and her books, you can visit her website at jillmariemorris.com. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Grave Talks.